Hello, I'm James Ross, but you might know me better as Sir Bertrand McGuffingham from the Rusty Quill Gaming Podcast. In real life, I run a multi-award-winning comedy night called Quantum Leopard that's a lovely fun time for everybody. No punching down, no picking on the audience, gender balance booking, pay what you like to keep it accessible even in times of Tory, right in the middle of Zone 1 Central London and on a Saturday night. We've had loads of Rusty Quill listeners in over the years, and it, as an audience, you are a bloody delight, so why not pop in? All the cool kids are doing it, fit in and be popular, but, you know, in a way that isn't terrible. Did I mention it's pay what you like? It's pay what you like. So double your money back if you don't like it. Tickets via the mailing list. Sign up at facebook.com/quantumleopardcomedy or follow me on Twitter at James Ross Comedy. See you there. Do say hello.
Space. Game.
That is a big part of it.
And I feel like that kind of sums it up, really.
Rusty Quill presents Enthusiasm. Hello, friends and fans, and welcome to Enthusiasm, the show where we talk about a few of our favourite things. I am your host, Helen Gould, one of the best Rusty Quillers, and today we're talking about the Mass Effect video games, and I am simply overjoyed to be joined by James, Michelle and Mike. We are, as always, going to introduce ourselves alphabetically. So, James, what are your pronouns and what do you do?
Hiya, I'm James Ross. My pronouns are he, him. Listeners to this podcast will probably know me best from being in Rusty Quill Gaming, where I was in the top five of six cast members sometime. In the real world, I am mostly a comedian and a comedy promoter, and I run the multi-award-winning Quantum Leopard in London, which is a pay what you like, no punching down comedy night. And we've just won Best Live Comedy Format, which is an exciting national award. Ooh, go us. That's what I do.
Yeah, woo go you indeed. Very, very big congratulations. Well done. Next up, Michelle, what are your pronouns and what do you do?
Hello, my name's Michelle Snow. I'm one of those she, her people. And I edit things, audio things for Rusty Quill. And I also run a news outlet for trans people out of my bedroom with some friends of mine called What the Trans, which is a thing you could listen to. But you should probably listen to this first. Like, don't stop listening now and go look that up. Do that later.
That is extremely considerate of you. Thank you. How many episodes of What the Trans are there now?
We just put out the 72nd over 4 years because we're not very good at keeping a schedule.
But you know what? That's not too intimidating of a backlog, at least.
Oh, it absolutely is, because sometimes episodes can be 2 hours long. Like, it's a lot. But people do it. People are going through the backlog. And I know, because Spotify is weird and doesn't show all the episodes for reasons I don't understand. And I get emails about every 3 days saying, where's the rest of them? I'm going through them sequentially. And I'm like, why? All of that stuff is so out of date now. But people do. People do try to listen to it from the start, which is awesome. But also, I don't know, it wasn't what I was expecting. Because it's a news thing. News becomes old really quickly. So why would they want to hear about the terrible things were happening 2 years ago when they could hear about the terrible things happening now?
I don't know, Michelle. I think you really get the best out of a long-running podcast experience by listening to it right at the beginning and then stopping about 77 episodes in. So
that is a Rusty Quill Gaming joke. And finally, Mike, what are your pronouns and what do you do?
Hello, everyone. My name is Mike LeBeau, and I am the head of video for Rusty Quill. I'm responsible for all of our video outlets. I currently run a show called NPC, New Player Challenges, which you may have seen on our brand new YouTube channel from Rusty Quill. I'm a streamer and voice actor. I played Tim in the Magnus Archives. I'm currently playing Paul and Richter Collins in The Town Whispers. And possibly some other things to come as well, because I've had a few casting calls recently and a couple of callbacks. So good things to come. You might hear more of my voice in and around the digital universe.
Wonderful. Okay. So, you know what? Full disclosure, I am recording this right after I have finished streaming some Mass Effect 1. So I am very much in the mood for this, for talking about this odd, expansive and much beloved game about aliens and war and, as my friend Jamie put it, baby's first politics.
That's really good.
However, it's very much at the level of, oh, slavery is bad, but maybe the army can also be bad.
See, it does have the moral choice thing of like paragon versus renegade rather than just like good versus evil, which is a very slight development. But like what I'd really like to see at some point, and if there are any games devs listening, then just go for this. Here's an idea for you. Just dispense, like just you know, cut the nonsense with the moral choice system and just have the options called left wing and right wing. You know, it's a bit easier, isn't it?
Right. So how would all of you describe Mass Effect to someone who hadn't played it, assuming that someone is listening who doesn't know about the games?
Space. Game.
That is a big part of it.
And I feel like that kind of sums it up, really.
I mean, he's not wrong.
Space. Dot, 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 exclamation mark, question mark.
Yes.
Excellent. I like that. That's succinct and to the point.
Well, listen, I was going to call it a space opera, but there's an argument to be made that it's not necessarily a space opera because it covers a lot of different ground.
I've got a point about that. Right. So, so firstly, like it is a grand epic spanning several games with threads that interlink them. And, you know, it is a masterful bit of storytelling, particularly branching storytelling, which is unbelievably complicated. And it does that really well. And the writing is surprisingly adequate for a video game, which is... Like, it's genuinely surprising to have something that where you're not, like, yanked out of the narrative immersion by going, like, that is a very bad sentence. That's a really horrifically written sentence. Why have they done that every 30, 60 seconds? But, like, so I would say, you know, in terms of, you know, the quadrilogy, that, you know, what you basically have is you start off with a space opera, which is potentially a grimdark space opera, depending how you play it. And that leads into, like, a sci-fi setting, what is essentially a heist movie, followed by a war film, followed by a crushing disappointment. That's how I broadly structure it. But like, if you know, I'm reminded when I started playing Mass Effect, people were like, oh, you know, because I was I'm a few years behind the technology curve because Harbor is expensive and I've got other things I need to spend money on. And so when somebody found out I was playing the Mass Effect series, there were several people did like, oh, you're starting. It reminded me of somebody who told me they were once they were on a train and they were starting to read War and Peace, and you know, sort of an old gentleman walked up to them and said, you're beginning the journey.
Michelle, though, how would you describe Mass Effect to someone who had no idea what it was?
They would have to understand, like, the story of Cassandra, but it's basically the Cassandra myth in space.
Interesting.
Because all the way through, your Shepard is just like, oh no, it's all horrible and something terrible's coming, and people are like, whatever. And then the end is just like the third game should have been just Shepard going, I was right for 30 hours straight.
Yeah, it's in the I told you so DLC.
Yes,
that is.
Man, yeah. I mean, the ending of the third one fundamentally should have just been like Shepard stood there, arms folded. Like that Easter egg from Jeff Goldblum in the Jurassic Park game, where if you complete all of the objectives that are set for you in the game and do all the extra stuff, you just get Jeff Goldblum going, well done. Now go outside. And that's the Easter egg.
I'd love to have like a sort of a custom character designer thing, and it's just for Shepard's hand, and you get to like customize it, like, you know, the rings, the nail varnish, nail length, knuckles, proportions, blah blah blah. And it's just for right at the end of Mass Effect 3, where he strokes she can just go flick the V's at you.
Yeah.
All the way through.
Can I just say now that the only correct way to play Mass Effect is with a female character?
I agree. I 100% agree with
that. I'm of that opinion as well.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
I've been told that the voice acting is a lot better with female Shepard.
Yeah,
as well.
No, that is very true, yeah. Because when you play as the male Commander Shepard, it basically is just Metal Gear Solid in space. Like, you've got some bloke who's just got a very deep, bassy voice who's like, yeah, let's action. Whereas you're right, there does seem to be a lot more character depth with female Shepard. That is true.
And it sort of accidentally becomes the most like feminist video game of its time by mistake, because they didn't put any effort into like making the character, the female character, like have female-specific responses from other NPCs. It happens, but not that often. No. The model, the walking and animations and everything is the same. So what could... It was a lazy choice of them to do that, but what that means is that the character is basically just like everyone else, and the future is portrayed as far more feministy utopia than you would expect for a game made between 2000... And, for a series made between 2007 and 2012, which were not the most... Looking back now, there was a lot of weird clangers going around intellectually around that time when it comes to gender politics.
I absolutely agree with what Michelle's saying there. I started off playing, I've only really been playing it as Fem Shep. I've never really bothered with a male Shep run, partly because I think it really changes how you view the story. So when I first started playing Mass Effect 1, I played it as a Fem Shep, and I customized the model and just on a whim, just because the preset looked a bit more interesting. I played it as a black female shepherd all the way through. And it really, playing it as that character really changes how you view the dialogue, because when you've got the difference between playing a hyper masculine, super aggro, marine type action hero, and playing it as a black woman going through it, particularly in Mass Effect 1, when you're talking about themes slavery, collaboration, struggle, all of this sort of stuff, it's a very different script, right? If you're talking about resisting slavery and you're a black woman, that rings very differently than if you are somebody who's got a knee for a jaw, some linebacker, right? If you've got that and you've got that character and he's talking about slavery, it's where's your MAGA cap? Are you complaining about the face nappy that you've got to wear? Is it about political correctness gone mad? Is it the lip? Is it the fact that you can't say anything anymore? Is that the kind of slavery that Saren is going to inflict on the galaxy, right? It rings very, very differently, and it plays very differently, and I think it's a much more interesting game if you play it that way with that character.
I was really struck, actually, Michelle, by your comparison of Shepard as Cassandra, because that really is, and the idea of Shepard as being cursed as well, cursed with horrific knowledge, and the whole universe, whole is like Troy, and spoilers, and the Reapers are the Greek soldiers, and their Trojan horse in the first one is
Saren.
It's Sovereign.
Yeah, I think that was intentional of them. I mean, if you really look at all the parts that make up the Mass Effect universe, they stole a lot of things. Like the Geth.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of Battlestar Galactica, what the Geth is about. Like that whole story, up to a point.
Ooh. Yes. Okay, so the Geth are a robot species that were created by another alien species called the Quarians, and the Geth started to become self-aware, and this freaked the Quarians out so much that they waged war on the Geth.
They outlawed them totally.
Yeah, but the Geth are actually quite good at fighting, and sort of won.
As it turns out.
And they were an oppressed people too. That's the part that you don't really find out about until two games in. The Geth were an oppressed people that were attacked, and they defended themselves.
Yeah, it really... Because I'm playing Mass Effect 1 through at the moment, and I'm just completely indiscriminately mowing down every Geth I see. It really does... It really does literally makes you think...
Well, I mean, you find out in Mass Effect 2, I mean, again, spoilers, but I mean, spoilers, that they are, a sort of a distant faction within who've been manipulated by the Reapers. And also that you've also got, there's a sense in which, although you're mowing down individual drones, because their consciousness is collective, it's quote unquote not really killing. So, I mean, a whole thing about this is do you see the Geths, do you see the Geth as being, analogs for people? Are they, which, obviously, we're mammals. We think that everything is people. We anthropomorphize everything. If you've watched that video of a little girl feeding rubbish to a Roomba, it's adorable. But that's going to destroy our species, right? Because we'll create the seeds of our own destruction. Go this hunter-killer drone that's entirely autonomous. Oh, it's adorable. It's got googly eyes on it. I love it.
That's the one thing about our species I like. We could occasionally be nice to things. That's like our best quality.
But I mean, I suppose in terms of that, it's like, well, I mean, do you view the Geth as being an oppressed species, which you're obviously invited to do by the game, or do you view them as being a tool, a program? Like, you know, is artificial intelligence, you know, life that is worthy of protection, which is, you know, a grand sci-fi theme that will become relevant at some point as a sort of a live human political concern.
I mean, yeah, I absolutely do view, I'm absolutely of the belief that AI can develop enough to become a people. And so I have a lot of sympathy for the Geth. And yeah, let's talk about Legion a bit. So
yes, I think this is where I was hoping to step in, because Legion's storyline is actually one of my favorites in the entire Mass Effect trilogy.
Go for it.
Well, I mean, just because, like, Legion has got so much depth as a character. Because, like you said, in Mass Effect 1, you're introduced to this enemy, quote-unquote, called the Geth. And it's your job to destroy as many as you can so you can uncover the mystery, work out what's really going on, and who the Reapers are eventually, spoilers, question mark. And then, you know, you've got... There's not really that much development in Mass Effect 1. Then, as we've said, you hit Mass Effect 2, and you're suddenly introduced to this character who's part of the enemy. You learn a lot more about the Quarians and what actually happened during the Quarian Geth War. You learn the turning point, which for me, as kind of similar to James's and Michelle's points, sort of pokes a little bit into the Uncanny Valley, fearing AI, creating something that is superior to humanity or, you know, another species, and then turning on it as a way of being able to cope with that. And obviously you have many, many, many other themes there as well. But there, like I say, you're introduced to Legion, who brings all of that story home by talking about the collective consciousness, by having the interactions between Tali and Legion. Like, they are some of my favorite interactions, and I would regularly choose Tali and Legion as my two squad mates in a lot of the stuff that I did, because I loved listening to the conversations that they would have, given that it's sort of like they're on two totally different sides of opposing forces is the word I'm going to choose, but really it's just they're worlds apart in a war that started over fundamentally a big misunderstanding, boiling it all down to one core element, in my opinion. And Legion, as I say, you start to develop, or I did at least when I was playing through, you start to develop feelings for Legion, like as an entity. No, Helen, no, get your mind out the gutter. Goodness me, we haven't got to space dildos yet in this conversation. Keep it in your pants.
We will get there. Yes. Yeah. Yes, indeed. On that, we're going to take a little break and we'll be back in a second. And welcome back. Okay, so we started to touch on this, and now that we've talked about some of the general things, I definitely want to talk about the squad mates. There are a lot of them. This may well take the entire rest of the episode, but that's okay, because you spend a lot of time with these people and they are all wonderful and unique in their own special ways.
Helen, I have a question.
Oh, yes.
Are we going to cover Andromeda, or are we just ignoring that that exists? I'm happy to ignore it.
My impression of Andromeda is that it shouldn't really count.
Yeah, it's sort of a Mass Effect themed game, you know what I mean? But like, whereas the others are like generally, to varying degrees, RPG first person shooters with a strong storyline, Mass Effect Andromeda is sort of a vaguely Mass Effect themed puzzle platformer. And, you know, just because it looks a bit like a thing I like. I mean, you know, if my five-year-old son, I love my five-year-old son, he's great. If there was another child that came up to me wearing his skin, I would not love it the same. It is a very different experience.
Okay. Do you know what? From what I've heard, that sounds like an apt metaphor.
Man, I've played Andromeda, and I'm laughing because you are not wrong.
I like to paint a picture with my words. It's a Hieronymus Bosch painting, but it's there.
Why did it have to be so bad? It didn't have to be. So much potential.
It didn't have to be.
Michelle, I paid $79.99 for the early access deluxe edition.
Oh, you never do that.
And
you never
got
the deluxe.
I got it a week before everyone else with all of the bugs, and I played it, and I was like, why did I pay for this game?
I mean, it's one of these things that you have the right to do as a consumer of culture, right? Is you get to decide where within a series you get to cut it off. You can make your own canon. You can say that Mass Effect ends at the end of Mass Effect 3, or maybe even Mass Effect 2. Like, I was a teenager. I was a massive fan of Red Dwarf. For me, Red Dwarf ends at the end of season 6. That's it. None of it, the rest of it happens, and that's fine. And it's better as a result.
Yeah. Like for me, Community ends after season 3.
Yeah, for me, Shameless ends after season 1 because it ended so nicely. I was just like, you know what? I don't want to watch the next 25 seasons of this. This ended at a place that was satisfactory for me, and I'm going to leave it there. And it was
25.
Good.
25 is a lot of seasons.
I don't think it was that literally, but it was an absurd amount of seasons at the end where it had that thing where they've been through like 3 whole casts.
Wow.
Wow.
Except for one guy. And I was just like, well, I've seen the James McAvoy season. He's a beautiful man that I enjoy watching for reasons that are probably quite shitty to him, to be fair. But I like watching him move. And he was done at that point. So I was like, well, I've come here and I've got the best part for me. And that's fine.
Speaking of people that we like to watch move, Gareth.
All right.
Oh, yeah, Gareth is my shepherd. Always gets with Gareth every time.
Same. Okay, again. Just because I know how complex this game is. So in Mass Effect, you gather up friends along the way. You meet people and you say, do you want to join me on my spaceship? And they will usually say yes. You start off with a couple of human mates. They're called Caden and Ashley. And then as time goes on, you collect Garrus, Tali, Liara, Rex. And they are all aliens. And then in Mass Effect 2, you get even more. And in Mass Effect 3, you get a couple more there as well. So all of these people that we're about to talk about are non-player characters who spend a lot of hours with you in the game and have their own little unique dialogues and their own little opinions about things. And in the DLC, one of the DLCs in Mass Effect 3 called the Citadel DLC, you can get them all drunk and have a party. And
I regret not buying that DLC. I really, really do. After you and me talked about it the other week, Helen,
yes.
Genuinely want to go out. I want to get the new updated Mass Effect just so I can have all the DLCs.
Yeah, honestly, yes. The Citadel DLC is absolutely worth it. Anyway, yes. So one of my favorite is Garrus. He is romanceable in Mass Effect 2, and my shepherd always ends up in love with him. And Garrus.
Sorry, I don't know why I did that then, at that particular romance point, when we've discussed several other romances, and we will again. I can't do that for every single one of them.
That's all right. I'll fill in the next one, James.
All right,
don't worry.
Thanks.
I've got the next one.
Yeah, you take the next one, Mike. Michelle, cool. If you could be ready for number 3, that'd be great.
Okay. I feel a bit on the spot now.
That's fine.
That's okay. Don't worry. But yes, Garrus is a ex-cop turned vigilante who turns out to be a bit of a dork. And loves to look at weapons.
Calibrate things. Oh, sorry. Yeah, look at weapons. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. That's what I was going to say too. Look at weapons. Yeah.
He does calibrate a lot of things.
Specifically that one thing in Mass Effect 2 for about 40% of the game.
Yeah.
it's the far future equivalent of a fidget spinner. And that's just what he's doing for like the whole thing. Like it's compulsive. Like it's actually an issue. Like this is it's an issue of. And I mean, Garrus in many ways is a better character for knowing that he represents a degree of neurodivergent representation, right? Because he's just filling with this one little thing for the whole thing. Maybe that's what.
Oh my god, I would love that. That's going to be my new canon now. Every time he turns back around after saying, "Oh, can it wait? I've got to do these calibrations," he just turns around and plays with a fidget spinner for the next like 4 hours.
Yeah, so Garrus has ADHD. I'm pretty sure that Liara is autistic.
I think you can certainly put that interpretation on her behavior. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm not autistic, so I'm not sure if it's my place to do that. But when I was playing the character, I was just like, oh, okay. I know people like Liara and they happen to be autistic. This makes sense.
Interesting.
Do you want to tell us a bit more about Liara, Michelle?
Oh, well, for people that don't know, Liara is an Asari, which, and I'm going to explain this, and people are going to think this is a very, very different kind of game that we've been talking about. They are an all-female race that reproduce via brain sex things I don't understand, and they don't really go into as much detail as you would think on that point of how that works. They live for like 1,000 years, and they're very advanced and very, very cool. And Liara is basically an archaeology nerd turned like crime boss slash information broker.
Private spy, like private intelligence agency.
Yeah. She deals in information, kind of like a Game of Thrones character, only she's got computers and stuff.
Yeah.
And eventually she becomes like, I don't know, like hacker crime god by the third game.
Yeah, she's very cool.
Called the Shadow Broker in the game, but that's basically what it is. Just someone who sits in the sky and knows what's going on everywhere and moves chess pieces around. But she starts off as someone who is just a bit socially awkward and strange. And in the first game, you can find her at like multiple parts. So you have like three planets you can go to, and she's on one of them. So you can find her in your own time. But if you leave her to last, when you find her, she's been trapped in this cave for weeks.
Oh my God.
And she doesn't believe that you're real. She believes that you are an hallucination. And that only happens if you choose to go and meet her last out of the three choices.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting.
Yeah, I didn't.
I had no idea.
I didn't know that until like a playthrough maybe 3 years ago I did. And I was just like, Jesus, this game is the gift that keeps on giving. With little things like that.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. Oh, damn.
How about you, James? Who's your favourite? Oh, wait, Michelle, is Liara one of your favourites or do you have another favourite?
I love Garrus. I do quite like Liara. Mm-hmm. I think my absolute favourite, though, has got to be, I guess, kind of Thane Krios.
Yeah, I was waiting for the Thane. Yeah, 100%.
Because he's the other person my character has relations with most of the time. Because starts off gunning for Garrus, not getting there in the first game. Then falls for Thane. But spoiler alert, he dies, and then she falls into the arms of Garrus. That's my shepherd's romantic journey.
I'm always so tempted by Thane.
Yeah, because you can't help but love him. He's got a good heart, and he does terrible things, but he means well, and you kind of feel sorry for him, and you get into that weird space where it's like, is this pity, or is this because he's hot? Like, you know what I mean?
But you could fix him.
Yeah, oh my God, that's it. That's what it is.
Do you know what? I genuinely hope that Thane Krios was actually like the template that they used for Cobropulus Michael in Rick and Morty. Whenever I see that character, I just really hope that they're Mass Effect fans as well, and that was the foundation that they used for that character.
The other cool thing about Thane is that he has perfect recall. And so if he can like experience a memory like it's in real time, and it's like an actual like flashback for him,
which is a horrible way to live. Imagine if you remembered everything, you would lose it, right? You would lose it if you could remember absolutely everything.
I wouldn't. Every single one of my actions has been purposeful and morally valid throughout my entire life. I don't know about you, amoral losers, but. I look back on every single thing. If I could do that, I'd just be glowing with pride the whole time. That's how you could tell that I was doing it right then. No, you're right. It'd be horrific. Particularly if you're an assassin. Like, I just...
Yeah.
That is pretty bad. I would argue that is one of the worst things you could have.
Thane is a very sad...
Yeah.
He's a very sad frog man.
But I mean, like, I thought that the backstory with his species and the Hanar was, again, a really nice bit of world building, because it's like, you know, what do... societies, what do civilizations do under particular material pressures? What then becomes right and reasonable and like a good thing to do for you collectively, and also for, you know, for specifically your children, right? And, you know, the position that his species is in is like, that is the least worst option given the material circumstances, which I think is, you know, a very nice way of framing.
I like how you're giving very, very in-depth and intelligent answers. And mine are basically, I like to bang this alien in game.
Right, well, if you want to know who I would bang, right. I think if that's where we're going, Michelle,
it's where I'm taking then, us clearly.
Well, if then strap in.
You know who I'd like to... I would strap in. I would like to take us to...
so let's go to Bangtown, shall we? Discursively. But... So, I mean, for me, obviously for me, it has to be Miranda, because, you know, a high cheekboned, dark haired, omnicompetent Australian is not just my type, but my wife. So that makes it quite an easy choice for me. But obviously, I've played as Femme Shep, and she's not a romanceable option, certainly in the first two, if you're playing a female Shepherd character. But yeah, I think that she's... It's quite interesting as somebody who is significantly overeducated. I find she's quite identifiable from that point of view. But I mean, the other character I think is particularly interesting is Mordin Solus. I have a lot of time for Mordin.
Mm.
And I like the bit of him doing the Gilbert and Sullivan, I think, in Mass Effect 2. That's a nice little.
Yeah. I am the very model of
Scientist Solarian.
Yeah, that's the one.
I won't be able to remember the rest of it. Again, that's a really, really nice touch. And again, it's a nice way of adjusting, like, okay, well, you've got this species that only lives for 40 years. What do they do? Well, they operate at twice the speed. You know what I mean? If you're going to have a reasonably accomplished species. So I think that's been interesting. So I think Miranda and Morden are probably my favourites there. And I've got a lot of time for Tali as well, because she just seems nice.
She's very sweet. Yeah.
She genuinely seems to be like the kindest one of all of them. Like everybody else has got, you know, I say more of an agenda. They've all got an agenda. That's good writing, is that all of your characters have got an agenda and things they want to do. And critically, things that they won't do and things that will, you know, and how they interact with other motives. And one of the things that the whole series does so well is, you know, you choose option A, therefore that closes off option B. You choose option B, that means that option C cannot happen, things like that, which is, really nice. And I think that they demonstrate that particularly well with the relationships. Like, if you've made certain moral choices, there are certain moral relationships that you cannot have, right? If you if you go down the renegade route, you cannot have a romantic interaction with Samara. You know, it just these are things that happen within it. And you know, I think it's good because it means that you've got these characters and you've got these characters who are romanceable options. But like in the real world, if you've done horrible things in front of them, some of them aren't going to be on board with that. Which I think is, you know, that's it is you know, the closest I think that video games have come to having well-drawn characters and like a reasonably realistic, though obviously stylized, model of relationships. And you can have people that you like, you know, capital R romance, and you can have people that you have a capital F fling with.
good cover.
A family. Oh yeah, if you fiddlestick them right up. Oh yeah. I'm aware it's a family podcast. So I'm trying to keep it PG. But again, you've got that sort of, you know, diversity of relationships. And you know, again, there are characters who, if you romance them, you cannot romance others. And you know, at a certain point, some of them will ask you to choose. You know, if you've perceived some options.
That happened to my character. And I wasn't trying for that because it was the first time I was playing Mass Effect 1. I didn't know that that was possible. Then out of nowhere, Liara and, what's his name? Caden came up to me just like, look, you've been messing us around. You got to pick. And I'm like, I didn't know that we were courting. I was just talking to my friends.
Really easy to do with both of them, especially Caden. You have to basically be a complete dick to Caden to get him to not think you're flirting with him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's hungry. He's thirsty, that Caden.
But like, just on that point, Michelle, like, I genuinely thought that was a really, really nice touch. I can remember when I played Mass Effect 2 for the first time, and you had that moment where your save file copies over and you forget who you romanced in the first game, and suddenly, out of nowhere, they're like, well, who's this then? You know, arms on hips. And you're like, no one? Oh, my God. It was so cool to have a game with the foresight to sort of put that sort of a plot line in. Mm. Oh, my God. Yeah. Excellent
writing. So who's your favorite then, Mike?
Character-wise, or characters you want to have a fling with?
Is there a difference?
Either and or both.
Because one of my favorite characters that I always loved playing with was Tali. I just had a lot of respect for Tali, and I was like, hey, by the way, should we just hang out a lot more? And like, when you're chatting and all that kind of stuff, it kind of gave me the same sort of vibe that I got when I was playing The Outer Worlds, not to be confused with The Outer Wilds, because there's the engineer that you meet in The Outer Worlds, whose name eludes me right now, and you just meet this pure soul, and you're like, I'm going to keep you safe by keeping you close to me. Don't go off and die somewhere else in the B plot, please. Just stay here with me in the A plot. We'll wear our plot armor together and nothing bad will ever happen to you. There was Tali. I enjoyed playing with like characters like Liara and all that sort of stuff because as you've said, Michelle, they were really interesting, and like their story arc through the three games changes so much. For me, that was actually slightly off-putting that they started as like this sort of socially awkward kind of like, you know, archaeologist, and then they end up being this crime god who like is constantly in the shadows watching every move that you make. For me, I thought that was a little too much. I thought they drove that character a little too far. Maybe that's a hot take.
I can understand that. I mean, that made sense to me because in the second game, I mean, at the start of it, Shepard dies horribly. Yeah. And then it's two years later and Shepard's been brought back from the dead. And in that 2 years, it sounds like shit got dark for Liara. Horrible things happened in between. Like, well, one of her best friends died and she's the only one. She's trying to tell everyone about the Reapers and people are like, no, go away. You're weird. So then she just ends up selling secrets to random wealthy people.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, fair. Very fair. And actually, speaking of selling secrets, that brings me on to my second favorite character, which is a little bit of a left field entry. And that is good old Dr. Chakwas. I love Dr. Chakwas. She is legitimately one of the people who I would always go back to on the Normandy. Even if she had no dialogue, I would just go back to have a little chat with the good old doctor who sits down in medical and has like this sort of pseudo-cynical view of the world, but eventually in Mass Effect 2 we'll join you for a drink and you cheers over like not being dead. I have got so much enthusiasm for Dr. Chakwas, and they're one of the characters that I wish the Mass Effect team would have driven further, because there's so much for that potential for that character to grow. And whether they go through the romanceable route and they have like a fling with the doctor, or whether you go through the other route where they become pivotal to the story in some way and actually end up having like a bigger role, which is where I was hoping they would go in Mass Effect 3 but never did. Like, Dr. Chakwas for me sort of represents the underdog of writing where you have a character with enormous potential but doesn't actually go anywhere and then nothing ever happens to you necessarily apart from getting a much better job. Good for her.
I really like her as well. She has kind of a sort of a stern Judi Dench vibe.
Yes, exactly. She's like...
I love that. I think she's so cool.
She's got, without the sort of raw sexual energy, she's got that Lady Demetresque kind of like atmosphere going on, in my opinion. You know, that commanding, authoritative person who, you know, takes a front seat when they need to and then is happy to sort of play with the team when they need to. Yeah, 100%.
It's really bad that they didn't have a mission or something where you would take her with you, really.
Right.
She would have been a very interesting squad mate, I would think.
And the Star Trek like parallels that they could have drawn and all of that sort of stuff. There was so much there to be written and it just didn't happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, there you go. Dr. Chakwas, everyone.
Lovely. I'm really glad that you said her. She's great. We're starting to come towards the end of the episode.
Oh, wow.
I know.
Oh, we haven't got through like half of the characters. We haven't even talked about Ashley Williams at all.
We haven't talked about any of the Krogan, despite my enduring love for Rex.
There's just too much to cover in like an hour. There just really is.
I know. We're going to have to do a part two.
I mean, that explains to me, Helen, why you put in the show notes, this show is about Krogan erasure, which I thought was a peculiar thing to say in advance. But like... whatever you want to do with it, your show.
The Krogans are great. The Krogans are like a dinosaur alien species that really like to fight. They're also an oppressed species, very much an oppressed class.
Because
they literally got genocided.
And then made to not reproduce anymore by another species who was like, you shouldn't breed. And that was it, really.
But that was after they were used as a biological weapon against another sort of galactic threat. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on. But I mean, like, also as part of the lore is that they have had several, nuclear wars before they reached the space age, before their Salarians find them and uplift them. So, So it is interesting. I mean, that's one of the great questions of one of the great sort of moral dilemmas within the series is what do you do about the genophage? And there's lots of sort of real world parallels to that in like world politics, right? And history. You've got a defeated power that is enormously powerful. Do you let them like run rampant again? What do you use them for? Do you let them determine your own destiny? What are the consequences of that? But like, I mean, if you take it away from that and you just have sort of the moral dimension, you assess it on your own terms without the analogies that you can put into it historically and politically, like it's still, you know, that is, I mean, it's one of the things that the whole series, I think, does incredibly well, which is it does what all great sci-fi does, which is, you know, it allows you to explore sort of grand themes of, yeah. you know, of morality and consequences in something that is a bit more like a sandbox that's got echoes of the human world, of human politics and human interaction from that point of view. But it's not always like that.
I think it's really interesting the point that you make, because one of the big comparisons that I made was actually an in-game comparison, because in the first Mass Effect, you play against a species called the Rachni, and there's that whole mission of saving the Rachni mother and the queen. And then when you get to the queen, she's like, man, shit got real. I've been stuck here forever, like, and it's not very good. So I'm boiling this all the way down. It's not very good. So, you know, can you give us like a place that we can go and be free and, you know, actually be able to live rather than being genocided? And like that in comparison to, is it Mass Effect 2, where you have Grunt and then you learn more about Rex and you learn more about the Genophage and you speak to Morden Solus and all that kind of stuff. Those two cross comparisons between those two species was always fascinating to me, especially when I went back through and played for the second time. So when I went back and did because my first was male Shep run and then I did a fem Shep run. Yeah. And the second time around, like you said earlier, James, like it changed a lot of the ways that I saw it, but also being able to play the full trilogy through rather than just going one, wait, two, wait, three. Like the differences between the Rachni and you know what Rex talks about and what Grunt talks about and what the Solarians talk about, like all of that stuff is just, I don't know, it's like the game is almost trying to help you puzzle it out as to what actually is a moral choice and what is a immoral choice. It's like, this one doesn't use nukes, but this one breeds ultra quickly. They're basically like rabbits and they will destroy an entire planet. What do you prefer? Only you can choose. Here's two buttons. Good luck.
Yeah, Mass Effect definitely had a massive impact on my politics in a lot of ways.
Really?
Well, it had a big impact on me in a number of ways. I was playing them all through the 5 years before I came out as trans, which was a really strange time. And also, Mass Effect was a good one to have because it's like, oh, I could be a woman in this and it's fine. And if anybody asks, I can just say, oh, I like looking at her butt or whatever. Because, you know, minor misogyny as a cover for being in the closet is a classic tradition that is thankfully dying. But yeah, because I never felt good with the idea of genociding the Rachni, the bugs. I never felt good.
Let them go
and
free.
And I didn't feel good to screw over the Krogan and allow the Genophage to continue. And then I realized, oh, the reason that isn't good is because those are terrible things to do to a species and a whole people. Maybe we should not, as a political idea, harm lots of people if we can help it. And that was the basis of my politics, which sounds very strange and simplistic, but it's worked for me ever since. And I think before that, I was like a teenager type who was just like, oh, I'm going to get all my politics from the West Wing or something. And then I thought Mass Effect was like, oh, it can be simpler and more pure and less up its own butt. That's what politics can be. All right, that's cool. And so I got a philosophy out of Mass Effect, which is basically, don't be horrible to loads of people if you can avoid it.
Honestly, I think that's a solid foundation.
It never developed much further from that. I'd said this about something else earlier, but I have the political depth of a Blink-182 album as a person. And I'm okay with that. I'm fine with that.
Fair enough. All right. I'm going to round us off with a final question. And that question is, if you were in the Mass Effect universe, what do you think your role would be? Like, do you think you'd be one of those bartenders? Do you think you'd be a smuggler? Do you think you'd be in one of the gangs? What do you reckon? Because I feel like I'd probably work for like the Asari consort, if you remember her. And I would just sit there and talk nicely to people until they felt
that's
better.
Really nice.
Aww,
I think that would be
Helen.
My job. What about the rest of you? What do you reckon?
I'm going to go first because my answer is probably the bleakest. So, well, yeah, I mean, it's one of these things. It's like, you know, when you talk to people who claim to have regressed through their past lives, they're always like, oh, well, of course, I was in Cleopatra's palace. And I'm like, no, for 95% of history, you would have been a peasant farmer who died at the age of 40-ish. If you made it past infancy. And it's like, so statistically, it's probably going to be something like that, right? And like within the Mass Effect universe, and I think, again, one of the things that makes it a bit more interesting is that you've not got this sort of post-scarcity utopia in any of the games in any meaningful way. Like even on the Citadel, there are like, you know, very conspicuous pockets of poverty and deprivation that you are directly confronted with. In the kind of the fluff in the background, Earth is referenced as being like colossally overpopulated. Populated and polluted and all of this sort of stuff, right? And humanity is not spread out to the colonies enough to kind of relieve that pressure, right? You never visit a substantial human colony of any particular size. So I suspect that I would probably be doing what I'm currently doing. And this is another thing as well, actually, sorry, just to make it worse. Like there's no evidence within the series of any sort of like countervailing pressure or like resistance movement or progressive movement for social change or anything like that to any significant extent. So, you know, if you're going to extrapolate from that information, you've got capital's tendency to accumulate in the hands of those who already possess it, and power follows that. So what I probably will be doing is what I'm currently doing now, but at a much higher rate of capitalist exploitation. But maybe I'd have a nicer phone, I think. So that's what I'd be doing.
Michelle, how about you?
Probably a similar answer, because I fell into journalism by mistake about 7 years ago. It was never the plan. So I think, I don't really believe in callings, but it's pretty damn close for me. So I probably think I would like to imagine that I would be a journalist, but the kind that doesn't get punched by Shepard for being a Bella.
I have never punched one of those journalists. I always try and help them do their jobs.
In one playthrough, I did punch that one journalist for being a racist jerk. Okay. And then it got the renegade points. I was like, oh, I don't like that. But yeah, I think that's where I would be. I would be one of those people running around the Citadel asking Shepard to do things and hopefully not getting punched.
Mike, what about you? What do you think?
Helen, I know exactly who I'd be.
Oh, yes?
I'd be the shopkeeper who just stands there and goes, oh, let's command the shepherd over there. Can you say this voice line into this microphone, please? That would be me. And then I would just play it on a loop every single time someone walked into the shop. Knowing that every single shop in the entire arcade was playing the same voice line.
I think it's appropriate that you've chosen one of the few characters within Mass Effect that has got a lot of audiovisual equipment. I think that's a very solid choice.
Yeah. That's exactly where my head was at. I was like, man, who vlogs in Mass Effect?
The guy who sells the video games in the second one.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was going to be who you were going to pick. Because that is, you can imagine that if that Solarian is their streamer, you know that they're streaming somewhere on whatever they
have. Yeah, yeah. Just out the back, they've got their streaming rig. It's connected directly to Twitch. And like all of the stuff that they do is just like a front to be able to sub the money to continue their massive Twitch viewership.
That is a beautiful answer to end on. Thank you all so much for this. It is so it's so nice to talk about Mass Effect with people who also love it. It's why I'm streaming it. I love this series of games so much. I'm really glad that you all do too. Listener, I will see you on the next episode. But for now, it's goodbye from me. Goodbye. And it's goodbye from all of them. Do you all want to say goodbye?
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Bye-bye.
Ah, this is my favourite podcast on the Citadel.
And the ad break ends and we cut to Drag Race Tuchanka. Yeah.
Enthusiasm is a podcast distributed by Rusty Quill and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 international license. It is directed by Helen Gould, produced by Laurie Ann Davis, with executive producers Alexander J. Newell and April Sumner, and edited by Marissa Ewing, Tessa Vroom, Michelle Snow, and Catherine Ranella. Thanks for listening.